Hello and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over the pop culture we all love to love. In case you are confused, this is not Guy Branum still doing his cis-hetero code-switching voice. This is actually Oliver Wang here hosting Pop Rocket in the place of Guy who couldn't make it. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are digital strategist Winter Mitchell. Hello, Winter.
Hello, hello, Oliver.
We got journalist Margaret Wafler to my right.
Hi there, Oliver.
And hello, Margaret. And sitting in for Guy, in a sense, is our great leader and podcasting mogul, Jesse Thorne.
Hi, Oliver.
As we always begin here when Jesse's with us. So, Jesse, what are you wearing today?
I'm wearing a linen. Look, I had a photo shoot this morning. Guys.
Oh, what? You dress like this every time.
I had a photo shoot.
You didn't see the glasses,
though.
The glasses were so on point.
They are on point. I'm not going to disagree with you about that, Winter. Those glasses are on point. I'm wearing a three-piece brown linen suit.
Okay. By?
I think it's Luciano Barbera.
Nice. And what was the photo shoot for, if I may inquire?
It was for a website called TSB Men, which is a menswear blog.
Okay.
Can I just say that I'm getting a very, like, 1940s doctor vibe off of you?
Yes.
I do have lapels on my waistcoat here.
He could be the Nick. He could after this and go do a like experimental surgery with a group room full of men watching.
Yeah. And diagnose Winter and I with hysteria. Yeah.
No, I feel like he'd rush in and say, I've figured it out.
Guys, I would not diagnose you with hysteria. I would prescribe you vibrators.
My
Thank
favorite
you so much.
Kind of doctor.
Thank you.
That's how progressive Jesse is. We like that. All right. Every week, we begin the show by taking a question from a listener about our own pop culture tastes. This week, if you could not be the audiobook narrator to your own autobiography, who would you choose? Jesse, as you are our guest, why don't you begin?
Oh, my God. Don't start with me. Start with them, because I didn't have a copy of the script before I walked in.
That's
here.
No excuse. All right.
Colin.
Fine. I'll throw to Margaret.
I would say Kate Winslet. The reason I would say Kate Winslet is that we're around the same age. The only thing I would need to tackle with her is the American accent. I want to make sure she has exactly my strange hybrid of, like, Chicago and California and 3 years in Alabama and then, like, nothing at all. So we'd need to tackle that together. But I also just think she's an amazing actress who has, like, incredible range, and she can perform, like, really, like, dignified, dramatic, amazing roles. And then she can be, like, a kind of punk, crazy person. And I like that range.
So let me just get this right. You would want her not to read in her quote-unquote natural voice, but rather for her to basically try to sound like you.
Yes.
Wow.
So this would be like Jamie Foxx and Ray? It's like an impression, an extended impression.
Yes, I would just like to see what Kate Winslet could do with me.
And everyone's like, she really captured the essence of Wappler.
Exactly.
And you're like, I don't know. She was sort of doing a Wappler.
No, I like this idea. I want Kate to do me then in this case. She'd just do all of us. That'd be fantastic.
I mean, what's the point of having a great actress do it if she's not going to like try to capture you?
Okay, excellent point. Winter, how about you?
Scarlett Johansson.
Mm. Her voice or not her voice?
Her voice.
Her voice.
For her voice.
No, I mean like the movie Her voice.
Like the voice
that
from
she does
the movie
in Her.
No, that's her voice, by the way. That's actually how she speaks.
I know, it works always.
The reason why I would want her is because in her voice was so sensual but open and relatable. And I thought it was just like cute the way she would like talk to him and sort of to be able to convey that many emotions without ever being seen and to also be a robot is like phenomenal. So I always, this sounds really narcissistic, but I think I have a really nice voice. So I want someone, if I couldn't do it, I don't know why I wouldn't do it. I would totally do it. But if I were unavailable and she was like took an interest in my life and wanted to talk about it at length in a book form, sure. I would want it to be her because she's got a very sensuous, relatable girlfriend, nice, kind of like pleasant listening. Listening to her is a pleasure. It was a pleasure listening to her during Her. There's a lot of hers.
I would want Kate Winslet playing Scarlett Johansson doing the voice. I think that's,
doing the voice
that would
her.
Be that would really prove her worth, I think.
Yes, I would. Mm-hmm. I think she could do it.
Scarlett's, you know, I feel like she's super underrated and she's given us nothing but great film and
can
and
I tell
beauty.
You that I rate her very highly.
Thank you. She should. She's amazing.
In all categories.
I do really like her, but I have to say her voice and her, I had different feelings than you.
It just felt like she was like a girlfriend. She sounded like a girlfriend. She sounded like when you call someone up and you want to hear their voice, you want to feel warm and you want to feel like, I kind of want to bang her, but I kind of want to like her have her read to me, but I kind of like, you know what I what I
mean? Wait, why are those two things mutually exclusive?
No, because she sounded like a nice, pleasant, comforting, sweet person. And she really was trying to, and that's why when, you know, I'm not spoiling anything, but it, when she ends up just sort of like disappearing, it was.
That is kind of spoiling.
Is it really?
Kind of.
It came out 2 years ago, okay?
Statute of limitations.
And let's not even talk about how it was an apology letter to Sophia, okay? So, you know what I'm talking about. Sophia Coppola.
I can figure it out, all right. Yeah.
So anyway, no. I just think Scarlett is...
Apology? It's like when you're sorry about something.
Oh. Okay, I think I got it.
I just like Scarlett
a lot. Not like a single letter. A long string of letters collectively are also called
sorry.
A letter.
Sorry.
Jesse, you've had some time to marinate on this mm-hmm. question.
So I really like this accent idea.
Right?
But I'm not having... So here's the thing. So my first thought was Stephen Fry when I thought accent.
Oh.
But then I thought I want something even more authoritative than Stephen Fry. And also, like, let's be fair, I have a tendency towards self-parody and I don't need to bring Stephen Fry into that. And so I'm going to go Liam Neeson.
Mm. Yeah.
And stately.
What I'm thinking is when he's narrating, he can use his beautiful Liam Neeson voice.
Mm.
But then maybe when he's doing dialogue, he should do his weird American voice, which my co-host on Jordan Jesse Go, Jordan, does a spectacular version of that I will now ape pathetically. But it basically goes like, uh-huh, uh-huh, yes, uh-huh, I'm from Brooklyn, uh-huh. There we go.
I guess Americans do say uh-huh more than
uh-huh.
anyone else.
Right.
Pronounce their R's heavily. But yeah, in his standard Northern Irish accent, I'll gladly accept.
All right. Jesse's down with the Liam Neeson's as the voiceover.
Hold up. Change of plans.
Oh.
My late step-grandmother, the legendary Mother
McCree.
You had
one too?
Yeah.
So and, random.
And she was from Belfast, and this is how she talked. No joke. This is 100% for real.
Hello, Jesse. It's your stepmother there. Is Bernie there? Oh, can I? Hello, it's your grandmother. Hello. I've just been up on a ladder, painting the ceiling. Yeah, is your stepmother there?
I think it'd be fun to have her narrate
for the entire book, though.
From heaven.
I think you should just have one character be her.
Oh, yeah. Should she play herself?
Yes.
Just someone else?
Yeah, she's the only person who gets to play herself because she has that voice.
I feel like Pop Rock has just lost all of its Northern Ireland listeners after that impression.
Come on. I just said my stepmother's from Northern Ireland.
All right. Let's see. For me, if I were to go with someone, if I could not narrate my own autobiography, well, if I wanted gravitas, the late Ossie Davis. I mean, just no one could do
that
better.
Yeah, that's a good pick.
If I wanted menace, Werner Herzog. Who I thought was super underrated in that really not great Tom Cruise film, Jack Reacher, but he was deliciously villainous in that film. But I think I'm going to have to go with Theezo Miihara, which is, I think, an only reference that in this room, Winter, you don't know who Winter, how do you not know who Theo is? Jesse, you know who Theo
is.
Oh,
Theo, yeah. Theo.
Theo.
I didn't know that was his last name.
Yeah. So
Theo
he has a last
Cosby
name.
Show?
Theo Miihara was a DJ on KMEL in the 1990s.
Ooh.
And then he came down to Los Angeles on the beat and did that for quite a number of years.
Voice sounds like sex in motion.
That
Ooh.
Is exactly.
Oh, Oliver, is that what you want out of your autobiography?
I mean,
okay, I'm changing mine to former Wild 107 host Chewy Gomez.
Okay. Chewy's got a decent voice. I like Chewy's voice.
I
there
know.
You go. But Theo,
it's going down tomorrow night.
At Great America.
That's all I remember.
Everything was about Great America.
And going down there. You were going down. I got two tickets.
I feel like everyone outside of the Bay Area has no idea
no
what sneakers, any of these references.
No jerseys.
But yeah, Theo Miihara basically had the platonic ideal for sort of the late night or the rush hour drive home radio voice that was so incredibly appealing and sexy for across gender, across race, and he happens to be Japanese American, and so I'm sort of giving the Asian Am kind of solidarity shout.
I didn't know that was his last name,
Theo Miihara.
He used to date Theo,
and used to date Don Robinson from En Vogue. That's some random trivia right there.
Smooth,
not Don Robinson, the starting pitcher for the Giants. Don Caveman Robinson
could have been both. Who knows? Who knows?
Dude, if that dude dated Don from En Vogue, he's got it going on.
Yeah,
that guy can narrate.
His
my
voice
book.
Is sex in motion.
All right. Well, thanks to In Turnaround on the Max Fun Reddit for that question, and you can share your own answers with us in the Pop Rocket Facebook group or on the previously mentioned Max Fun Reddit. Coming up in this week's show, we have pop culture things that have jumped the shark, as well as late bloomers. Plus, we'll be each sharing, of course, our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Margaret.
I got sucked into Unreal, which is a new show on Lifetime. Basically, this show is
ratchet as hell.
Well, it is a scripted show, but it is copying a reality show. And it is like The Bachelor in that there is one guy and about 20 women competing for his love. And in this particular show...
Hold on.
Yeah.
Point of clarification. Is it presented as... is it a scripted version of a reality show, or is it a scripted show about the world of a reality show,
it
like
is
a behind the scenes?
Yes, it is the second one you said. So, because it does, it gets so hard to talk about because there's so many layers to it, and that is what is actually great about the show is that some of the people who worked on the show, like the woman Marti Knoxon, who is the executive producer and the co-creator of the show, she used to work on The Bachelor. And so it's clearly taken from some of her experiences. And it shows how the producers of these shows are in this uncomfortable position, but also this very powerful position of really manipulating the people that are on the program. Manipulating the contestants, manipulating the guy who's there to find a wife and or just clean up some publicity for himself. So it just gets into the real complexities of, I mean, on Unreal, we're really following this female producer who, you know, identifies as a feminist, wants to be, you know, this kind of like giving, open-minded, kind person, but finds herself in these situations where she has to exploit people's weaknesses all the time. And that is actually her job. That is what she is supposed to do. And one of the standouts on the show is this character named Quinn, who is played by Constance Zimmer. And she is the, you know, just head maven of the show. She's the main producer. And she's just this very, like, half wicked, half soft, you know, incredibly complex character. And Constance Zimmer is just doing a great job playing her.
Can we say, is it safe to say that this is the golden age of actresses named Constance?
I was going
to
say the same thing. Got Constance Wu,
Constance
Zimmer. We just need a third and then the trifecta is complete.
Yeah, and then we can cast a whole Henry Miller play or whatever, right? What's the one? The Scarlet Letter? No, that's not the right one. What's the one about witches?
Do you mean the show that's about witches?
No, the play.
The Arthur Miller play.
Arthur Miller play.
Crucible.
The Crucible. There we go. Wait, so is Unreal a drama? Is it a comedy? Is it a parody?
Well, it's an interesting question because it's not a parody in the sense that, like, Burning Love
was. So it's not an absurdist. It's actually trying to play it straight.
No, it is a drama.
Okay.
I mean, there's comedic elements.
Right.
There's absolutely elements of laughing at what the whole thing is.
Okay.
But ultimately, it's a drama, and it's going for that.
All right. So Unreal on Lifetime.
Yes.
Jesse, what are you all about this week?
I'm all about the new television comedy Catastrophe.
Mm.
Well, new to the United States anyway. It is a collaboration between Rob Delaney, who's a Los Angeles-based stand-up comic who is probably most famous for his Twitter feed, which is, I mean, one of, if not the best comedy Twitter feeds around.
You know, that's he's a not guy, damning with faint praise, all right?
No, not at all. He is he is really brilliant at that form.
Yes.
Really, really brilliant. And it just so happens that he is also super handsome. And he's handsome in a kind of... Yeah, he's handsome in a kind of like... you know, he is comedy handsome. Like, he plays a little bit like he's a parody of handsomeness. But he is a super handsome dude, and he made friends online with a woman whose name is Sharon Horgan, who is made a very beloved British sitcom called Pulling.
Oh, I love her!
Yeah, and it's sort of a romantic comedy, the premise of which is they are both in their, like, late 30s, early 40s. They hook up when he is in London on a business trip. They bang around for a few days. He goes back to the United States, and she finds out she's pregnant.
Mm.
So he moves back to London to be the father to this baby. And so it's sort of a romantic comedy built around the fact that in 9 months she's about to have a baby. Right. And what's great about it is that it is, you know, I'm not super romantic comedy dude. But it is genuinely romantic.
Mm.
Both characters are very well played, and it is really funny.
Have you seen FX's You're the Worst
Which... It is. It's similar to You're the Worst in some ways. I think it's a little sweeter than You're the Worst. Mm. I think it shares with You're the Worst, which I like a lot, too. And I'm not just saying that because I went to high school with the female lead of You're the Worst.
I did not know this.
Full disclosure, Aya Cash, a friend of mine from high school.
She's a lot older than I thought she was.
Well, she's always been younger than you think. She's always
is.
Been very small
right.
and pretty, which reads as young, I think, to some extent. But yeah, I think the thing that they share is that they both have sort of slightly dyspeptic leads, who great performances at the heart of them. Sharon Horgan is particularly exceptional, but Rob is really great too. I think that some of the other pieces outside of the leads in You're the Worst don't all fit together, and the tone is a little bit kind of sour. You know, some of them, Steve Agee's on the show, I think he's great, but on Catastrophe, it is a very realistic lived-in world. Some of the characters on the side are a little broader than others, but there's one guy who's obviously like a British guy playing an American guy, which just don't do that because it never plays right.
It works for Liam Neeson. It's not British, but you know.
Sort of. but it's great. I really recommend it. It's on Amazon Instant if you're in the United States, and I think it was already on television if you're in the UK.
Popcorn time.
Well, you're the second person in the last 2 days who've recommended it. Andy Greenwald, who's my favorite TV critic at Grantland, he loves the show as well. And so this is a hearty second endorsement. So
yeah, I read that piece and I agree with it 100%. Yeah.
Fantastic. All right, Winter, what are you all about this week?
This weekend, I went to go see Showgirls at Cinespia. My girlfriend Daisy Odell DJ'd and had me tag along with her. She's having me tag along to her gigs because it's just fun, and I've been helping her with some social media.
What was she spinning? And was it
that's not
specific
the point of
to Showgirls?
This, Oliver,
did it feature a
her
drop?
Her playlist is on SoundCloud.
Of course, that's a requirement. Did it do thing?
What
bass drops?
I don't know what Oliver's.
No, yeah. I want to know if she spun Showgirls specific music. Like, was
she
it
did.
Thematically accurate?
She did. She definitely played. Oh, gosh. You know, her. You go to SoundCloud and look up Daisy Odell. Her whole playlist is up there right now. It was actually phenomenal, and I periscoped a little bit for her. But what songs did she play that were in particular that
when
I.
When did Showgirls come out? Like at 96?
95.
Wow.
95. So
what's that? Like TLC or something?
You could do some TLC. That's
she
definitely
did.
In the range.
No, what did she play that everybody just went off on? Oh, Believe by Cher. But there was that was like.
I wonder what the demographic was at this particular event.
Oh, I don't know.
At this Showgirls screening.
Well, let me tell you, it was so. Cinespia is an event that happens every summer in Los Angeles. It's at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery, which is a very legendary cemetery. It's actually kind of morbid. I try to only go to like one or two. I went to
thank God you draw the line somewhere.
You'll only party on people's graves once or twice a summer.
It's like Candyman. You know, if you only say it twice, you're
Listen,
okay, but
Valentino
the third time.
Valentino does not mind. Valentino would love you to just drape your body over his grave.
All over his grave. No, because I'm literally sitting. I was standing out smoking a blunt, and I was standing next to the duck pond, and then they're showing the part where, I mean, I've seen the movie 50 times, but they're showing the part where she's, you know, screwing, what's his face?
Kyle MacLachlan
in the pool, and I'm like smoking a blunt.
And they're flippy-flapping.
And a flippy-flapping. And a flippy-flapping. A flippy-flapping.
Very bad pool sex. The worst looking pool sex.
I mean, it was the Oscar award-winning scene of pool sex, if you were going to put it there. It's better than most porn I've seen. So anyway,
only watches pool porn, by the
only
way.
Only pool porn.
Does he have a pool?
Yeah.
Forget about it.
I need it off land. No.
To be fair, once or twice a summer, she'll watch land porn.
It's got to be Waterworld.
But not in the cemetery.
Not in the cemetery. So you go to the cemetery. It's really nice. Everybody lays their blankets out. They show it on the mausoleum. God, this sounds morbid. Anyway, Daisy spun. I went. We were with a bunch of our mutual friends. And it was, you know, a very gay scene. But the thing is that it was the movie itself. I have a lot of memories about this movie coming out because I was so adolescent and like horny, and I needed to see this movie because it felt like the ultimate achievement to see a movie that was NC-17, that it was heavily guarded at the time, like no one was getting in without ID. And then I was obsessed with it. Then I saw it. Then I was like,
you're repelled in through a skylight. You put together a team, a weapons expert, a kung fu master.
Like Mission Impossible into
she
it.
She wore a cat suit.
Yeah.
16-year-old Winter is like pacing back and forth
15,
behind us in
15.
A situation room, and she's going like, okay, enhance, enhance, enhance.
I just really thought that the movie was going to be a lot better than it ended up actually being. And plus, it's 2 hours and like 25 minutes. So this is not like a 90-minute skip in a jump and a little romp. This is like aggressive. So, you know, I went to the screening. It was amazing. It was warm night. Got drunk on box wine. And right then my friend who's doing PR for it, he comes over to me and he's letting, we're behind the DJ booth. This is so, so sceney. But we're sitting behind the booth and he goes, you know, we have a surprise. And I'm like, who? And he's looking at me and I'm like, who? And then he's like, Elizabeth. And I'm like, oh my God.
That's so, a big deal.
Yes. So
Queen Elizabeth.
Definitely.
Sure. Sure. She came in like a Mini Cooper. She loves that movie.
I tell you, last night I had a dream that I had to take the queen to get a haircut.
Really? Yeah. It must not have taken too much. She had the same haircut for like 70
years. She got it cut short. And at first it was like too spiky. And I'm like, that is too spiky. It's too much.
Yeah, she can't rock that.
Like a degenerate.
It has to be a little more sedate. Yeah.
Right. Like a degenerate.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's okay. You're the king. So, anyway, Elizabeth shows up, and I don't know if you know, but like Elizabeth has this notoriously like really complicated relationship with Showgirls because Showgirls
destroyed
her career, and she was Jessie Spano
and made it too, in the way she probably didn't want,
and she spoke about like how she worked really hard for it. She really wanted it. People told her she wasn't going to get the role, and then she got it. And accolades always eluded her until she realized now that night that people love it so much. And that was the first public screening of it.
Wow.
So she
really?
Showed.
Wow.
Yeah, it's crazy, right? Yeah. Sanctioned screening or whatever. Mm, but anyway, mm. she was lovely and did her whole dance. Not the whole dance. That would have been really weird.
Wait, she danced? Like she danced.
She
like,
did the. Yeah, she was like,
shut
and I was like,
okay, we're on radio, so no one can see your hand gestures.
There was
right
just
now,
a lot of jazz hands.
It was
going
a lot
on.
Of okay. jazz
very fast,
hands.
Right. Frenzied manner.
It's a hand motion that can best be described as chicka-cha, chicka-cha.
Yes.
Yes, that was totally chicka-cha.
That was very chicka-cha.
It was just really fun. And I just love this time of year in Los Angeles. This is, you know, I used to like hate it because I was working. But now that I have my own business, I can spend a lot more time being free amongst the people. So it was nice to just sit there.
She deigns to come down from her throne. I'm among the masses.
Stepping across the mud puddle from everything plebe is to
here.
Plebe.
Everything here. And how do you do? And how do you do? So the movie was great.
So watching the movie in the cemetery, I've heard this from different people, creepy or not creepy?
It's creepy.
Okay.
You know, because there's a lot of fresh dead there. So when you're walking in.
Still juicy, as they say.
Yeah. There's like Sid, and he like died like a month ago. And the, you know, and it's
and
like.
And his picture is like painted
on
his gravestone.
Yeah. There was one guy that had like a knife on his one. And I was like, honestly, this is creepy. This is creepy.
I saw Purple Rain there one time. It was not creepy.
Oh, well, that's amazing. A good one to see there.
So I will recommend if we wanted to do another field trip, they're doing Pee Wee Herman.
I'm in.
I'm totally in. I love that movie.
I might have to bring my kid, though.
You totally have to bring your kid. But you should bring your children.
My husband has never seen Pee Wee Herman.
Which is
ridiculous.
I don't
think my three-year-old is ready for Large Marge.
You know what?
I thought you showed it to him already.
We watched Pee Wee's Playhouse together.
Large Marge. You need to just
indoctrinate. My 10-year-old nephew didn't really get it. He was just kind of like, this isn't that funny. I think it might just have been funny to like our generation.
I think it is very generational.
Yeah.
My 3-year-old loves Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Okay. So wait, which Pee-wee movie? Because there's two, right?
Oh, I am not going anywhere in public to sit down.
It's a gala screening of Big Top Pee-wee.
Yeah, I'm not trying to see Big Top.
Was that not good?
No.
It's a weak song. Very
weak.
All I know is the house, I think, in the first movie is actually that his house is in South Pasadena.
Oh, is it? Wow. I thought it was on a soundstage.
The exterior of the house. I'm sure the interior.
It's not
be.
A real. That machine isn't really in someone's house. They didn't just location scout. They're like, this amazing breakfast machine would make a great backdrop for a scene.
Everything about. You know what? I really want to see that. And
maybe you could do something with this Mr. T cereal.
This is great. This is all we need. We definitely, if we want to do another field trip, we should try that because that will be. I mean, and the rumor is that he's making an appearance. There is no rumor. He's totally showing up. But anyway, I don't know. I'm not the publicist. You guys figure it out.
Okay.
Just do it.
Mm-hmm.
Send us Bia if you're in Los Angeles.
We'll make this happen.
Yeah.
All right. So for me this week, I'm all about – and I talked about this as a jam a couple weeks back, but now that his actual album is out, Vince Staples with his new album Summertime 06. And I have – I'm just still sitting with it. I haven't even run through it, you know, more than really once at this point. But as someone whose primary engagement with music, and especially hip-hop, is first and foremost sonic. Like, I don't even really start paying attention to the lyrics until about the 18th time listening. But I just love the sound of Staples' new album. And let me just back up a second. So Vince Staples out of Northside, Long Beach – has been big in the L.A. scene, has put out a bunch of mixtapes, have gotten a lot of shine, and then now he has his new debut album, which just came out, called Summertime 06. And it is such a minimalistic-sounding album. And I think for a lot of people who found Kendrick Lamar's To Pimp a Butterfly, you know, too neo-jazzy, noodly, I think the sound of Summertime 06 is sort of what they would have preferred to hear, which, you know, is very similar to some of the stuff that we've heard from the producers on Top Dog Entertainment, which is Kendrick's label. And I think that what Vince has put together, the squad he put together for this album, is producing that sound. And one of the really intriguing things that he's doing on this album is using female voices not to sing kind of the conventional R&B hook, but really using them as part of the sonic texture. And can we hear a bit of Dope Man where we can hear this happening? Maybe he's going for an asthma effect to kind of bring it back to last
some
week,
whispery.
Right? But, you know, it's the type of vocal styling that you might hear in indie rock or in other places. I'm not used to really hearing it in hip-hop. And so the fact that – and this is not just on that one song, which is called Dope Man, where you hear it. It's throughout the album. There's really fascinating things happening in terms of texturally, the layers of it. I think it's a really fantastic album. And while I don't know if anything's going to knock To Pimp a Butterfly off of the perch of my favorite album of 2015, I certainly think Summertime 06 is absolutely in the running for, you know, top three status.
As somebody who does listen, who's into the rapper on a rap song, Vince Staples is absolutely as good as it gets. I mean, as an MC, the kind of emotional depth of his lyrics is so remarkable. And it's not something that I'm always turning to hip-hop for. Mm-hmm. There are relatively few hip-hop artists who give me emotional depth. There's a lot of other great things about hip-hop. It's probably my favorite kind of music, but that's not the main thing that I go to it for. But he is someone who reveals himself in a non-showy manner and can draw the feeling out of just a tiny little turn of phrase, just a little observation, so exceptionally. I think he isn't super technical the way that Kendrick is. You won't get any scoobity bibbity bop bops.
That's a compliment.
I do mean that as a compliment. But
you think he does? You think Kendrick does that?
Oh, go back, Rigor Mortis. I mean, that's his bebop lyricism right there, but that's not Vince Staples, though.
But and Vince is a much more direct rapper, much more of a Scarface, like a Los Angeles Scarface, not in terms of his voice, but
sure,
in terms of the depth of feeling and the sort of directness of his style. And I honestly think that Vince is as good a rapper as anyone else in the world right now.
I would just say, I actually think Vince does some really great vocal styling on here. I mean, there's this one line also from the song Dope Man where he talks about, you know, summer days selling hay, which I'm assuming means heroin. This is how disconnected from the streets I am. And then rhymes that with, you know, and summer nights selling.
Time since you're heroin selling.
Selling Wade. And just the way that he stretches it out syllabically,
I think hay might be weed.
Well, he's talking about, but then why the contrast between selling weed in the day and then
selling
hay in the day and selling weed in the evening?
I'm thinking
about
hay in the middle of the barn. So they were talking about heroin the entire time?
I don't know. I'm guessing.
Yeah, is this a dark album? I mean, it's called Summertime.
His stuff is pretty dark.
Yeah, I'd say it's not a happy album.
I would he was on Bullseye, and we just reran it a week or two ago. I would really recommend people listen to the interview. He is an amazing dude.
Yeah. He passes the Jesse Thorne MC approval of Bullseye, I guess, unlike...
Four thumbs up.
Unnamed artists.
Certain rappers who don't show up, which is to say, like, two-thirds.
I was going to say most of them.
Yeah.
Why don't you go to them?
No, don't go to them.
That'd be a documentary, Jesse chasing down rappers.
Where am I going to find them? You know, in the control booth in a haze?
Well, the
green haze?
Yes.
I don't think I'm prepared for that.
Mm. All right. You are listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back to talk about Jumping the Shark and Late Blooming Talent after this.
I listen to Bullseye because each interview makes me really care about who the person is and what they're doing, and makes me want to find out more about them.
I'm Jesse Thorne. I'll talk to Penelope Spheeris, the director of the music documentaries The Decline of Western Civilization and also Wayne's World, on the next Bullseye from NPR.
Welcome back to Pop Rock, and I'm Oliver Wang, filling in hosting duties for Guy Branum. With me in the studio,
Winter Mitchell,
Margaret Wappler,
and special guest
Jesse Thorne.
All right, so we're going to talk right now about shark jumping and late blooming. And the background behind this, I think this came up a few weeks or months ago, where we're talking about both artists or phenomena that we felt like, oh my God, why is that still a thing? It really needs to be over, or it really is over as a thing. But then we thought building an entire segment around that just seemed mean. Right. In other words, we're just making fun of people for being kind of, you know, out of the loop. So rather, we thought we would balance it by talking about the late bloomers. But let's begin with the shark jumps. And those, again, pop culture figures or phenomena that we think their 15 minutes are over and then some. I think I want to begin with Winter on this one.
Why, thank you so much, Oliver.
You're welcome.
Nightly news.
Mm.
I just I feel like the whole 5 to 7 o'clock sort of window before the wheel comes on is so, you know what I mean? Like, I used to really love watching Dan Rather is still to this day one of my favorite journalists. And he answered a question of mine on Reddit and I like started crying. It was like really ridiculous morning. But I really.
Not KTVU's Dennis Richmond.
Oh, Dennis.
Dennis Richmond
Dennis!
From KTVU answered a question of mine on Reddit. I would.
Dennis was
tears.
The Theo of KTVU.
There you go. This is such a Bay-centric show. I kind of love
it. I'll just interject really quick that Peter Jennings was one of my first crushes.
Yes.
I was all about Tom Brokaw.
Really?
Yeah.
Tom?
And also
you,
a great use of Saphir, you know, doing like a little double entendre. Like,
there
Tom, you'll get Brokaw. That was just one of the best battle lines ever, I just want to say. But anyways.
What about you? Oh, you, Dennis Richmond.
Dennis Richmond's my jam. Although
I'm not talking about local affiliates.
Okay, so.
Strictly national.
Strictly national.
Strictly big time.
I don't have, well, if I'm going to go national, I'm going to go Ray Suarez. Ray Suarez is my jam.
Okay.
Me and my friend Roman Mars, who hosts the podcast 99% Invisible, have bonded deeply over our mutual love of his period hosting the NPR show Talk of the Nation. Mm. But I also loved him as a host and anchor on the NewsHour. And Jim Lehrer.
Jesse
Gerr.
Gwen Ifill some love.
I got to interview Jim Lehrer once, and he was a magical human being. Like, brilliant and kind and, like, gravitas out the ears.
Yes, he
earned
that.
Gravitas.
But we are not here to praise. We are here to bury. So nightly news, it's over.
That was a very McNeil move right there.
Thank you.
Winter Mitchell, go!
I'm going to start doing that.
Oliver
right.
McNeil.
It's really good. I just, you know, as someone who's loved journalism, I'm not a journalist anymore, but I was a journalist. I studied to be a journalist. I wanted to be an anchor woman. I really looked up to Nightly News, even News Digest. If I were like Jessica Savage, even though it's so ridiculous that she was paid so much for 30 seconds of news per night is ridiculous. But the whole idea of being sort of the arbiter and guiding like this middle America towards what is newsworthy, it seems to be dated. It just seems to be a concept that is lost. I don't need to be in front of my television to see the summary of the day from any of these guys.
And
at
nothing
this point.
Is that linear anymore.
No, nothing is
there's
that linear.
No, there's no beginning to end thing that we all agree on. It's all, you know, everything comes in our Facebook feed is determined by what we previously clicked like on.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask, you think the bigger factor in bringing down the import of nightly news is the 24-hour news cycle, which is a little bit older, or social media, which would be the newer, perhaps,
social media, because if the 24-hour news cycle was going on cable news was going to do that, it would have flatlined nightly news, right? It would have, you know, a lot of people didn't have CNN in the 80s when it first sort of emerged.
Right, right.
Also, they were able to sort of go in depth on things that could not be encapsulated in like a 30-minute or 2-minute segment before the commercial break. And also, there was sort of like this prestige being like a Tom Brokaw or being a, you know, a Peter Jennings there was this prestige. And they also covered news in a way that was more. That's what I wanted from a news anchor. It was about being on the front lines, being in the midst of it, being at her, you know, Dan Rather was, I never watched
standing
CBS.
Standing on the wall, right.
On the wall. He was at, you know, all the hurricanes. He was covering it and he was talking. He was able to capture the danger, the hope, speaking to people on the street. And he assembled a news gathering process that is completely gone now. When I look at Don Lemon during, you know.
That's low-hanging fruit.
No. Because, by the way, he angers me more than anything that could be happening. Half the time when I was mad last week. Half the time I was mad because I was like, I want him to shut the fuck up.
You were, so you're saying that you were upset that those people got murdered.
Yes.
But more so that you had to watch Don Lemon on TV.
On TV talking about it.
I feel like
it.
Don Lemon is the salt that goes into the wound that's created by something like Charleston.
Yes. It's like, it's just so, and he's on cable, but I'm talking about, like, I'm really talking more about the Brian Williams of it all.
I was just going to say, Brian Williams has now, it feels like, almost put the nail in the coffin.
Yes.
On. Like, it has taken away the last vestige of authority that the nightly news had.
Yeah.
Where, like, here was this person making up that he had been in, what was it again?
In a war, like a helicopter kind of under fire situation.
And he wasn't even in the fucking chopper.
So the question is, do we foresee a near future where the entity of the nightly news, as Winter describes it, is basically gone?
Well, can I tell you something?
Yes.
Here's where I really thought hard about this, you guys, okay, as a student of news. I thought about what has become of people who are not that great of journalists after the fact, after they leave the chair. What do their careers become like?
Digital media strategists.
Shots fired. Oh, my goodness.
Do you walk to your car alone?
Jesse's going to be bleeding in about
publicists.
2 minutes.
They become publicists.
No, I'm talking about like Katie Couric. You know, she goes and hosts and then she ends up being like, I'm on Yahoo. And then, you know, you have, but then you have somebody like Peter, homeboy from today, Gumbel, and then he goes and does real sports, which is so strong and news gathering, and he has assembled a great team. I don't watch any episode without like shedding a tear, and I'm not a huge sports fan, but I find his stories compelling. So you always have to look at where do their careers go post the chair,
right?
And if they still love news, they're going to be able to do something amazing with it. Like
Larry King. If they're good journalists, they'll always have work.
But right. I'm asking about the half-hour national news summary show that all of us grew up with. Is that really on its way out? And our networks going to think, you know what, we don't need this?
I think it'll always exist in part because of local news. Like I do think certain cities really hang on tight to their local news broadcasters. I mean, Chicago, for instance, like the Chicago 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock news is a much stronger franchise than what LA has as the 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock news.
There's also a financial component with the local news, which is essentially that the way that television stations are structured, the local news is where their money comes from. They don't make a lot of money on network programming.
Right.
They make their money on the Seinfelds from 11 to midnight and the local news. Mm-hmm. And they can sell all of the car dealership ads they need to sell against that local news.
Right.
That's something that I think will guarantee that institution will last another 10 or 15 years.
But again, I feel like Winter's really talking about that half-hour national show, the Walter Cronkite entity or experience.
Well, I do think the NewsHour, because it has a different kind of authority to it than the big three, you know, NBC, ABC, et cetera, there's something about that I could see that lasting a bit longer.
Different funding model,
It's
too.
A different funding model, and it's also just like there's a different authority model even going on there, where I feel like I do tune into NewsHour when I want to see news I feel like is less corrupt than other forms of it.
Yeah.
Although I hate to tell you, but the NewsHour is in the last 5 or 7 years has gone through several it is an emergency. The NewsHour might go off the air. Funding crises.
Really?
It's like Sesame Street.
Because
this makes me want to give. You're probably going to
Sesame Street's the only one that doesn't go through that.
Okay.
But they have to. But the one thing, I mean, and we can, you know, end on this point if you want to. But the one thing that I find to be most upsetting is that it made me want to be a journalist. Mm. Dan Rather made me want to be a journalist. Mm. And I am excited because I feel like journalism is making a resurgence, actual journalism, because too many people keep fucking it up.
Mm-hmm.
Rolling Stone. But there's also like this sort of idea that, you know, Walter Cronkite wasn't a good looking man. He was grizzled. He smoked on air. But he told stories, ripped them from the newswire, put the stories together and told it and gave people information. I feel like that's not happening anymore. I feel like Brian Williams spent more time researching his hits on Jimmy Fallon when he would be on the Jimmy Fallon show than he actually did. Sorry, shots fired. That's why you're on NBC now. Now you know.
He's very handsome, though.
Goes along.
Guys, I don't know what you guys think about Brian Williams, but I think he's really funny for a news anchor. Am I right, guys?
That's what I want from my news. But hilarity.
You know who else is funny? Justin Timberlake.
Right. Get him to do the news.
And Jimmy Fallon.
All right, Jesse, you have an example of shark jumping?
Shark jumping. Well, the main shark jump that comes into my head, and this is going to be a controversial one, so I apologize in advance.
Shit. I like it already.
Bracing.
6 feet under.
We have to argue right now.
Granted, I have not watched 6 feet under now in 10 years or so, however long it's been since it was on television, but I feel like 6 feet under is a perfect example of a dramatic television show that had a really strong vision about – I don't remember exactly how far in it was, but about two seasons in,
wow.
They sort of ran out of their strong vision. Mm. They're like, let's get Rainn Wilson in here to act weird. And then they're like, okay, let's just start having random crap happen. And I think that from what I've heard, it ended very well. They really wrapped it up nicely.
It was amazing Prius ad.
It was a show where the tone went from a kind of plausible, realistic tone. You know, I mean, it had the death angle involved a little bit of, you know, a little pseudo ghost action, but like essentially presented in a naturalistic way to about 2.5 years in, I'm guessing this is based on a hazy memory. It's just like for me, the episode was where
David was high on crack.
Hedvig the Angry Inch substitute guy. What's that guy called from the serial murder show?
Oh yeah.
Who was wonderful on that show? So good on that show. There was just that one episode where just like out of nowhere, like. He just gets in a van, does meth, and gets raped.
I knew it.
And you're just like, this doesn't really. This is like
one of the best episodes ever.
Exactly. I'm with Winter on this. Right. I loved that episode. And I do think that it's 6 feet under. I'm glad you brought it up as an example.
It's a cool part of this serial comic family tale. this extended. Rape episode.
What's up, dog? Is what it's called.
It was dramatic and amazing. And I disagree with you that it was always on a naturalistic tint. I mean, it wasn't. The show had Nate's dad, like, popping up and talking to him as a dead corpse. I mean, it was never in a fully...
It was an imagined...
But,
you know,
yeah, but the way they presented
I think
it...
The overall...
Dead people were talking to him. I mean, at times, people would say things to him. That's not natural.
Beckoning him home if you want to really go there.
Oh. Yeah. So I do think the show always had a little rip in the fabric.
I don't know. I'm not comfortable going there.
I do think the show always had a little rip in the fabric of, like, going there.
So you don't think it ever... You think it maintained its quality throughout?
I do think it got wobbly. Okay. I think about, like, the penultimate season was not a great season for them.
Yes.
And then I think they started to pull it together. Mm-hmm. They realized that the wheels were starting to come off a little bit, and they, like, delivered for the end.
Yes.
I mean, I think the last two or three episodes were beautiful. Mm-hmm.
For me, it plays into a thing that I am uncomfortable with in a lot of dramatic television, which is, and there are certainly, you know, great dramatic television series that are exceptions to this. But I feel like there is kind of a certain point where, I don't know, I just feel like if you're going to make a soap opera, make a soap opera. If you're going to make something that's about actual people, don't just start having stuff happen to them. Mm. You know what I mean? That, to me, is the lazy storyteller's excuse, to have an outside force just be like, oh, and then this crazy thing happens. The same thing happened in they sort of managed to right the ship, but Friday Night Lights is another really wonderful show where they had a series of being really lovely. They probably got some notes from the network that said this needs to be more teen drama-y. And then they just started having random stuff happen for like a year and a half.
That's
everything
life, though.
Goes
life is random.
I was going to say that I do feel like
happening.
Life is like that. I mean, somebody
Melrose
can step into a van and get raped.
Yeah.
That happens.
Yeah.
For some reason, I'm
especially
relatively okay with this on Downton Abbey, though. I don't know. Like, oh, everyone, it bothers
they don't
people.
Have vans. You know,
they're in this funny,
no
like...
No vans.
No vans.
It's always kind
maybe
of
the...
funny.
It's in the cellar. But Downton Abbey, I think... I think Downton Abbey is where this idea of shark jumping began. We were talking about Downton Abbey.
Yes, yes.
And because Margaret, because you're the one who was hating on it.
Yes, the shark is like sailing through the air still for Downton Abbey and has not dived back into the water. It is just in free float.
It is definitely
free
a
dive.
Show that got,
I don't know what analogy I'm talking
that
about.
That got real silly.
Yes.
I should point out that in terms of the metaphor, you jump over the shark is not jumping over you.
Yeah, what is the metaphor?
It's from Happy Days where Fonzie actually does a motorcycle thing where he jumps over the shark.
And that's when the show just went straight to hell.
Right.
So the show has to jump over the shark. The shark is not jumping over
the
shark.
I like the vision of yours better, actually. The idea of a jumping shark seems great, visually speaking.
Margaret, here's the thing. Before Fonzie jumped over that shark on Happy Days, it was a really trenchant social satire. You know, it was like a regular All in the
but
Family.
But didn't he start right. like dating a single mom?
I would think when Mork came into Happy Days, that might have been the sign. But
right,
anyways.
Even Alien, yeah.
Yeah, right. Anyways, Margaret.
Well, okay. I was going to talk about this in a music context because I do think there is shark jumping that happens musically. And I think for me, one of the first ones that I became really aware of was Sting. I feel like, you know.
That's a classic.
Yeah. I mean, that was very confusing when he just slowly became more and more lame after being really cool
it's
in the police.
Loot. Once you bust out the loot, it's over. It's over, really.
And when you have a wedding with like 10 white horses at a castle and like there's just no way to recover from becoming like this strange like Disney theme song man that he became. Like, I still am a diehard police fan. I still love just about everything they ever did. And I think the music still sounds so cool and like timeless and perfect. And then and there was even a time where I could hang with like a couple of Sting solo albums.
Like Dream
and
of the Blue Dolphins or Blue Turtles.
Dream of the Blue Turtles. I mean, there were some really beautiful songs on there.
God,
but
that sounds terrible.
Okay.
It had its moments, but.
I mean, if I can jump off from that point.
Yeah.
What major 80s figure has never been considered, and Prince, we got to exclude him because that's the obvious answer, someone who's never jumped the shark. But I feel
but
like
Prince jumped the shark pretty definitively. He just kind of got his train back on the
when did
rails.
He, when did Prince jump the shark? With the whole symbol
like
era?
Under the Cherry Moon?
91-ish to like 1998.
Bat Dance. Bat Dance. I think
Bat Dance
era. Which winner is going to go?
Y'all leave Bat Dance alone, man.
But I mean, also
nominated for an Oscar.
Also the late, also like the
kind of defense.
Just got off of Warner Brothers putting out every song that he's ever thought of writing through 1-800-NEW-FUNK. That era is not a lot of solid gold in that era.
1-800-NEW-FUNK. Can we set that up as the new Maximum Fun hotline?
I don't know. In my memory, I just never remember a point at which I thought, oh, Prince is just over. Maybe
not, even
maybe not great,
the
but
buttless
that's not
pants?
The same thing.
Oh, that was perfect. That was everything.
But all right. So maybe even Prince is still part of this, but any other 80s figures who have managed to maintain their stature?
Oh, well,
on top of the game?
I feel like David Bowie has had an interesting relationship with this because at times David Bowie has just unleashed some horrid things on the world. But then he's David Bowie and he will always come back to some sort of center of cool.
I think his kind of elegance sort of carries him through those things. There's something I think, especially with music stars, there's something about seeming like you need it or want it.
Yeah.
That makes it real
thirst.
Hard to take from somebody who's
they call that
past
thirst.
There.
The kids do.
I think that's something that has, I think, really benefited Jay-Z as he has gotten progressively cornier over the past 10 years. He has been managed to keep himself reasonably in the center of popular culture. Mostly just
up until Tidal is because he wouldn't speak.
Unlike almost any other rapper, his thing is reserve. And so while he's done some mega corny stuff and made some not very good records, the one thing that's managed to just keep his toe in the game is
Beyonce.
He's still
she is a major bonus for
also him. It doesn't ever it almost never seems like Jay-Z wants it. And the times that the times that he has gone bad, you know, like the Samsung thing or whatever, like those are times when he is or Tidal. It's times when he is showing himself to actually want something.
I think Jay's at the precipice
Yes.
If he were to fall, I don't think it would surprise anyone. But I might agree with you, Jesse. I don't think he's jumped off the cliff yet. I just think he's kind of hanging out there, maybe dangling a foot, you know.
But I was just saying Madonna a second ago, because I feel like that's the other person that people are constantly debating. Like, is it this album that she slipped off? Is it the album
It's not
before?
That she slipped.
What was her first album? That's the one where I felt like it was all downhill.
Ooh.
Wow.
From when she put out her first record.
Those are fighting words in this booth.
Clearly someone who's never going to be a guest on one of Jesse's shows.
Because
okay.
Here's the thing about Madge, Queen Madge, is that I've never, ever count her out. I'm a diehard fan. However, and I would never tell her this to her face or in a public forum except for this podcast. But I'm saying it in a controlled environment that I just think that maybe she should just take a minute and just maybe think about slowing down.
But here's the thing. I think the problem for Madonna ultimately is like her
trying to catch up. It makes it's
well,
it's,
she, if you go by your Jay-Z theory, she wants it too bad. She desperate.
Yes.
And her craft and art is wanting it, like doing things to want it. That's what she is good at.
But what if your
body
she can't doesn't want you to want it?
She will never be able to be Cher. You know, like Cher has had 25 years of being like Las Vegas Cher.
Right.
Yeah.
And the reason
Cher
is
was
because
born like that, basically.
Cher has this both an outsized personality and persona, but she also is a great singer in a Cher type way. And so she can always go like, well, fine. Or like Bette Midler or something. Like they can just go like, I'm going to go do Cher over here. I'm going to go do Bette Midler over here. And if it's just gay dudes that come, that's fine.
But Madonna's brand is being like fresh and with it and
cool.
And she just...
And she also can't really sing.
She can't really... Hang
Margaret,
anymore.
one of your side points that you made off the air around this idea of shark jumping is whether or not that effect or our perception of shark jumping is affected by binge watching, or we can really extend this to anything, binge listening, for example. So, for example, someone who let's say 16 and discovering Madonna for the first time and decides to basically hammer through her entire immaculate catalog in a few days, that the perception of the fall off may not exist because we can talk about this since we can trace all of these phenomena over time. If you erase that space, does that change our impression of how artists or artistry rises, falls, et cetera?
Yeah, I think the reason I brought that up is because I watched Homeland on binge the first like two or three seasons. And I loved it. I stayed engaged throughout those two or three seasons. And then I did some reading and catching up on what people thought about different parts of the show. And everyone was like, oh, it jumps the shark in the middle of season two. It just goes off the rails.
Right. That's like a conventional wisdom about Homeland.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely. Right. Like accepted critical wisdom. And I, watching it, I definitely was like, okay, they're having Brody stick around a little too long. Like, I love Damian Lewis too, but after a while, he does have to die or get blown up or whatever is going to happen to him. But they kept him around, and I, it was like I noticed it watching it, but it wasn't nearly this thing of like, oh my god, this show is over. And I think it was because I was just inhaling it on my couch, like all in like two or three weekends.
Do you think that it's because of the way that you were inhaling it, so watching so much at the same time, or because you weren't participating in a social conversation that established the...
Yeah, I mean, I think both. I mean, I was aware. I did see all that clamor about Homeland before I ever watched. So I was aware that there was some moment in the show where that happens. And I was kind of halfway watching out for it. But, when it was happening and I knew it was happening on the show, I still was like, this really isn't that bad, people.
Because
this is okay.
I wonder if it had been, had a show like that been on television 20 or 25 years ago, the mid-90s or something like that. And let's also presume that you weren't a professional culture critic, so you weren't hanging out with other professional culture critics all the time. Whether watching it weekly,
we're professionals now?
Would have had the Margaret happens to be an actual professional.
We just play one. That is the second time you shit on my profession.
Oh,
it's a great profession, and I congratulate you on getting.
I am billing $12,000 next month. I think it's pretty freaking professional.
You're doing great.
Damn. Thank you.
You're doing great. God bless you.
I just put that out.
$12,000? Can I borrow?
Yes, you can.
So I wonder if
everybody can.
You had been watching it on a weekly basis as live, but you weren't part of the kind of conversation that the internet enables.
Right.
If you weren't reading recaps or looking at Facebook reactions to every week's show or whatever, whether the reason that you didn't feel like it fell off was just because you had a different opinion about that period where it allegedly fell off.
Well, I have to say, when I was recapping Mad Men for the LA Times for the first, I forget now, two or three seasons, I would write my recap, I'd put it up, and then sometimes I'd go and read other people's takes, and I'd be so shocked at those moments where somebody would be like, this was a disastrous episode, and I loved it, or I thought it was like a shaky, weak episode, and somebody else loved it. So it really does go to show that if you are operating in a vacuum with a show, you are going to have your own opinion, and that some of it does turn into mob mentality, this idea that, like, oh, yes, it fell off the rails.
Because I have to say the first two shows that came to my mind when thinking about this subject were actually negative examples.
Yeah.
They were Seinfeld and News Radio, two okay. shows that I watched as an adolescent were very important to me, and which commonly accepted shark-jumping moments. News Radio, it's after the passing of Phil Hartman,
well,
of course.
Yeah. Yeah.
And on Seinfeld, it's after Larry David left. And those have, to some extent, been kind of retroactively grafted onto it, although obviously Phil Hartman was a very clear storyline.
Yeah.
For me, I love both the last season of News Radio and the last few seasons of Seinfeld. So for me, it is an example of meaning it, they did not jump the shark.
Right. And I mean, this is obviously an inherently subjective topic. Not everything that people love, everyone loves. I do want to come back to Margaret's point just to kind of close this portion out, which is to say that there has to be a very experiential difference between watching a show in one weekend versus if it plays out over 6 months. Like, there's just
right.
no way that you can, that your experience of it is going to be the same, and how you process narrative when you have a week to kind of process in between episodes as opposed to no time at all.
It is about patience too, right? If you wait a week to see your favorite show and the episode seems sort of off to you, you're like, damn it. You know,
yeah,
that's
right.
much
it
more
ratchets
frustrating.
Up the expectations in that week.
Oliver, I have a quick question for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, please.
Did and if yes, when Kobe Bryant jumped the shark?
Oh, wow.
As a Lakers fan.
As a Lakers fan? I don't know. Because the thing
when
about
he assaulted that girl?
No, because he became his sort of the afterlife, like the post, the two rings after that happened, you know, it was as popular as ever. And so fans forgave him for that. Many fans did, not every fan. The thing with Kobe is you like Kobe even though you recognize he's an asshole because he's your asshole. So really, it's really hard to imagine.
Asshole.
Don't point
firmly.
At me. Don't point,
point
at
your
me.
Asshole
right.
at me.
I want
to
identify
my asshole.
Your asshole
to be Draymond
okay.
Green, okay?
Who's really not an asshole. The thing with Kobe, the only thing that Kobe could do to betray his link with his fans besides, you know, sexual assault, I think if he went to a different team. I don't mean to make light of it, but I'm just saying that was an episode that
it
didn't
ruin.
No, but
that's what everybody did.
It's
a Chris Brown thing. If as long as you make some
Kobe,
hot shit,
I would argue that Kobe's
core fan. You can slam my face into a wheel anytime.
I don't want to make any equivalencies here between Kobe Bryant and who allegedly had a sexually assaulted a woman and the legal process decided otherwise, and Chris Brown, of whom there are like horrible pictures of a woman that he almost beat to death.
Either
well, it's
way,
the same thing.
I just don't think Kobe ever lost his fan base. It really didn't.
Neither
and you can
is Chris
you can blame
Brown.
That you can blame that on
Neither
misogyny. You can
Brown.
Blame a lot of things, but if Kobe were to leave the Lakers, that's the only one that it would happen. Otherwise, the fact that it's not like he went from Tim Duncan and turned into a monster. Like, he's always just been Kobe. Kobe's been Kobe, and I think people accept him right. for that because he's on the team that you love, and you don't care if that guy's an asshole or not because he's your guy. All right, I'm going to try to make mine really brief. And this is not an attempt to be a cheap, but I was really thinking about what to me strikes me as shark jumping. And I know anytime you talk about this, there's always a bit of desire of things that you want to see be over. And so I think for me, it's the terms artisanal and curated as adjectives for food, music, culture, film, or whatever.
You're so rude because I used curated this morning on Twitter.
Okay.
You
see?
Are a subtweet hater,
see?
Oliver.
I did not know this. It was not intentional. But
curated
I think
is the perfect
is
word.
Is this called subpotting?
Subpotting.
I think the fact that it is.
you marriage counseled this term. You waited till we were in a room of others.
Pro tip, retire curated, use bespoke, because I don't think bespoke is quite hit the peak.
Boy, you're
I don't
not
know
a menswear
what that
blogger.
Can I bring in one that I've noticed is getting more and more cachet is edited. Things that have nothing to do with words are edited.
I am really not crazy about people saying using edit as a noun, like I did an edit.
I don't know what it means.
It's like
on
a fashion.
Something
it's
that
a big
is
fashion
not,
word. Like,
yeah.
oh, this collection
this is a
was
great
edited
edit.
By blah, blah, blah.
In the same way that curated gets applied to things that have nothing to do with the art world.
Yeah.
And I mean, to me, the moment which I was like, all right, this then word
why
needs
is
to be
something
but you know
curated.
What? Useful. I've said it too. I've used curated.
I use it too, but
it,
I just feel like it's
makes you
the
sound
point
real
where
smart.
At the point at which you when you hear the word used and you just feel like, oh, I can't believe they're using that word still.
Oh, yeah.
That's when it's past its prime. And I think that both artisanal and curated invokes snickers from people rather than like, oh, yeah, I get what you're saying. I don't think edited is there yet.
Right.
I think outside of the menswear world, I think bespoke shouldn't get there. I don't want to see it get there. I see it getting there as people retire artisanal and, you know, again,
I don't
curated
hear...
out of its out of the out of the vocabulary.
How about handcrafted?
Yeah, handcrafted. Oh, my God. So kind of say this. There is an Indian restaurant in Pasadena that on their menu they describe it as handcrafted naan, which is like saying handcrafted tortillas. Yeah, because you have to make them by hand. That does not fucking make them handcrafted.
No, but
I
they're just
shit.
Basically trying to say we didn't unfreeze, defrost these, and just throw these into the oven. This was
that technically though is handcrafting if you use your hands.
Right. Exactly.
I mean,
all
of it speaks to this really personalized, individualized, highly specific caretaking.
Of course. Yeah. But at some point, and again, we're always going to have
it's authentic.
There's always going to be nomenclature that does that. I'm just saying with these two words, I feel like they become joke words now. And
yes.
Then the same thing would apply to people putting names together. What's the term for it? Portmanteaus. Like
Portmanteau. Yeah.
Like Bennifer, which is no more. And then there's also.
She had to squeeze it in, everyone.
Yeah.
She's been dying.
Yeah, hold the presses. We should not bury the lead of today's episode, which is that Ben Affleck and Jennifer Gardner have filed for a divorce, and Winter Mitchell could not be more over the moon about this.
First of all,
Ben, if you need a place to sleep tonight.
Holler.
Yeah.
Not at me, but
At Queen Everything.
No, I mean, listen, I just think portmanteaus are silly, but Bennifer was a good one. And out of respect for the relationship, I'm just going to say you can call me.
Jennifer Garner. You need a shoulder to cry on, Jennifer Garner.
Out of respect for your love, you can fall in love with
me and follow me at Queen Everything. I hate when people put people's names together because I also used to think it was empowering because it was like not having like a maiden name or a woman taking a name. It was putting two powerful names together.
But hate aside, is it as a trend, is it over?
No, people still try to freaking do it, and I never know what the fuck they're talking
about. That motorcycle still being revved up.
Same thing with Bay and Fleek.
Like to say referring to women who are pregnant and their bellies as bumps should really just go away.
That's really annoying.
Ever.
Look at her bump.
Just end this segment, which somehow just became words we don't like anymore?
That's going
to
be next week's episode, Words We Don't Like.
Words We Don't Like, Manmoa.
So we've spent so much time talking about the shark jumps, we barely have any time left for the late bloomers.
We are hateful people.
Even though our goal was to provide some balance to the force here, but if we can do it very briefly, what are your favorite examples of people who bloomed late? We'll start with Margaret.
Okay. Oh, gosh, so many. Well, we've touched on HBO shows a little bit, and I feel like one of my favorite late-blooming actresses from an HBO show is Edie Falco from The Sopranos. I feel like the minute she was on that show bringing Carmela to life, it was just like, where has this woman been? I mean, absolutely amazing actress. I mean, now on Nurse Jackie doing amazing things. I mean, I feel like she's just one of those treasures that for whatever reason, she just didn't get her time to shine until, she was like mid-30s.
Can you imagine how terrible Nurse Jackie would be if she wasn't the star of it?
Right, like a pill-popping nurse. Like, that is a hateable character.
It would have been Nurse Jackie Harry. I would have watched that, too.
Jesse, you have a favorite example?
Yeah, mine right now is ambidextrous Oakland Athletics pitcher Pat Venditti.
Okay.
I believe that's how his last name is pronounced. It might be Vendetti.
Is this the one who was mistakenly labeled in a newspaper article as being amphibious?
Yes, it is.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, amazing
headline.
Copy edit fail, but amphibious pitcher. Yes.
Yeah, so this guy was in the New York Yankees organization since college. Mm. I believe he's 29 or 30 now, which is basically as old as you could possibly be and not have made it to the majors and still be sticking around in the minors. He pitches with both hands. Switches back and forth during the course of a game for platoon advantage. And he finally made it to the major leagues this year with the A's, who are known as the team that will try anything if it works. and because he is a sidearm/submarine pitcher, the famous knock on them is that they're ineffective against batters of the opposite handedness.
But if you can just switch it up.
But if you can switch every time, it's bam. All because it's so hard to pick up the ball coming from essentially behind you. So that guy, totally amazing. And I'll also throw a shout out to R.A. Dickey and all other old knuckleball pitchers. R.A. Dickey, who became won a Cy Young Award at like 37 or 8.
Remarkable story. Yeah.
Yeah. So I love that. I love an old sports guy.
All right. Winner, you're a late bloomer.
Late bloomer is Leslie Jones, because Leslie Jones actually got on my nerves the first two episodes of SNL. I was like, you know, she's really ratcheting it up a notch. She needs to just bring it down. And I realized I was concerned about her because I was like, if she acts too black, they're going to fire her. So then I realized, no, this is totally what this whack-ass cast needs. So she's just, you know, to go from being a relatively unknown comedian, sort of doing her thing, and then going from, you know, she was in top five with Chris Rock's movie, then she's one of the Ghostbusters, and she's literally one of the best parts of the show next to the other Kate McKinnon. It's just, I'm really happy for her, and it'll be exciting to see what she does with her career. And the fact that she's an older black woman, she's like 6 feet tall, she's got like this crazy, like, spiky hair thing going on, which is not a look for me, but it looks great on her. And, you know, she wears like Ross. So I think that she doesn't look like Kerry Washington, but she's like making it. And she's hella funny. I love her.
Great. All right. And for me, my late bloomer would probably be Sharon Jones of Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings.
Are they related?
I have no idea. I'm guessing no. I feel like someone would have made that observation. That'd be kind of a great kind of pair of late bloomers right there, the Jones sisters or Jones cousins. Her story is she was basically born probably a good 5-10 years too late to have capitalized on the kind of soul music it feels like she was born to sing, but she was too young in the 1960s and early 70s to capitalize on that. And so, you know, she still pursued singing as a wedding singer and, you know, jam bands, and she was working as a corrections officer at Rikers when she went out for an audition for the band that was back when they were on Desco and eventually became the Dap Kings. But just the fact that she was able to realize this, again, a singing career that I think anyone, if you've listened to Sharon Jones, you just feel like she was born to do this. She was just born too young to do it at the time at which it would have made more sense, but she's been able to have a really phenomenal second career.
I would have liked to have heard Sharon Jones, the light R&B singer, though.
Right, like in the 80s
Sharon
doing
does,
Sharon
yeah.
doing like, yeah.
Yeah, some, like a Jeffrey Osborne
there
song.
There you go. I'm trying to picture, we should pitch that to Gabe Roth and say,
that's fun.
You guys need to do like the Daptones Yacht Rock album at some point. You know?
I do wonder if we're going to see more late bloomers now that people are just living longer. Do you know what I mean? Like, and switching careers. Like, I was reading recently that people, on average, switch careers 3 times now in a lifetime, which is different than what it was in the 70s. And so I do, and I feel like things are starting to loosen up just a little bit with, like, these crazy age requirements that we all had for, like, actresses and musicians. I mean, at least this is my hope, that we're now seeing like a generation of rock stars, for instance, have to be older and sort of equip themselves to be an older musician. Like, how do we do this?
I think you've sort of seen that with the evolution of talent shows, you know, going from, let's say,
talent shows.
Going from like American Idol to something like The Voice, where they up the age limit in a way that Idol didn't, at least not in the beginning, is this sort of recognition that there's actually a real audience appeal to see someone who's older rather than just like the 18 or 19 year old, you know.
Absolutely.
Adult contemporary
is more
of a
fantasy than being like 20 and breaking it is like, you know.
Well, everybody was so much older. I always think about the people who are late bloomers just in theory. Like, you know, Bradley Cooper's a late bloomer. He didn't become like a megastar until he was 35. J-Lo is a late bloomer. She didn't become super famous until she was 29.
Louis C.K. not until he was 40.
I don't know. Yeah. Hold up. People in their 20s can not qualify for late bloomer
status.
Yes,
they can in Hollywood. I didn't make
the system.
J-Lo's interesting because she was still like a starlet, but at 29. But and that is kind of a late bloom for the starlet phenomenon.
Yeah. I didn't make the system. The system made itself. But it's interesting that...
Did the system make itself?
The system made itself.
So the system is like a...
The system is...
It's the singularity.
Yeah, because...
But I'm hoping the system is starting to break down in those ways.
I want it to, because I don't think that we should be always giving all this freaking credit because a 16-year-old really knows how to cry on cue. Like, I don't...
Right.
I'm with that. All right. You are listening to Pop Rocket. We will be right back after this with our jams.
Hey, folks, this is Kevin Allison. If you love Maximum Fun Podcast, but you don't yet know about Risk, you don't know what you're missing. Check us out. Risk is the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share in public. So it's kind of like This American Life or The Moth, but way, way more uncensored. On Risk, we say nothing is inappropriate until something is. Every episode is an emotional roller coaster. Hilarious stories, shocking stories, horrifying stories, heartbreaking stories, tear-jerking stories. Risk is just jam-packed with stories you'll never forget, many from people you already know and love. So find us at iTunes or at risk-show.com or, of course, at MaximumFun.org. Risk!
Welcome back to Pop Rock, and I'm your host, Oliver Wang, sitting in for Guy Branum. With me in the studio, special guest,
Jesse Thorne.
Oh, Winter Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
And every week here on Pop Rocket, we ask our panel, what is your jam? And let's start with Jesse.
So I had recently got a turntable for the office. The office did not have a turntable in it previously. And
shocking.
Then that led me to a conundrum, which is what records do I bring to the office and what records do I leave at home where I do most of my listening? And what I ended up doing was so far I only have records that I've accidentally bought two of. at the office. And so I was listening to a Temptations album called 1990. And the Temptations basically, you know, there were all the classic Motown hits. And then starting in like the end of the 1960s, they started being produced by this guy called Norman Whitfield, who was a brilliant songwriter who had written, you heard it through the grapevine, among other songs. But his greatest gift was this kind of orchestral funk.
Psychedelic
orchestral funk. And this was the last album that he produced for the Temptations. It has a song on it that a Temptation song that's 14 minutes long.
Whoa.
They had on one of their albums, one of the Norman Whitfield Temptations albums called Masterpiece. We used to use it for the news broadcasts on my college radio show. And the reason we would use it is you could do an entire news broadcast just over the intro of the song before the Temptations started singing. It was like a 6-minute intro. It is a little bit ridiculous by 1973, which is when the song we're about to hear came out, but I still love it. It's absurdly overdone. But it's still the Temptations' brilliant singers. It is hyper
baroque.
It is baroque. It is rococo. It is somewhat rococo.
I love it when it goes all the way to rococo.
But this is "Let Your Hair Down" by the Temptations.
I feel like why hasn't Martin Scorsese scored a scene yet to that song?
Oh, you can hear that. You hear that? What's that thing called? The Rhythm King.
It's the Maestro Rhythm King that Sly Stone used. So this is clearly post Let's Write going on. It's post P-Funk and it's Motown trying to stay current with the times.
Yeah, and I kind of love it. And this is also post David Ruffin and Eddie Kendricks.
Oh, I was going to ask how many Temptations were in it. So how many Temptations down are we?
So one of the Temptations committed suicide during this. I think during this session, this year, the year that this album came out, one of the Temps committed suicide, and David Ruffin and Eddie Kendrick had left the Temptations by that point. So there was two original Temptations, several replacement Temptations. The replacement Temptations are also pretty great. I mean, I don't think you got that job unless you were pretty great. But it's a producer's album. And ultimately, they got rid of Norman Whitfield that year because they're like, why are we still making 14-minute long message songs? The only one that basically that ever hit was Papa Was a Rolling Stone. That ever hit for real. This song was top 10 R&B, but the only giant Temptation size hit with this. We want to go back to singing pretty ballad songs.
So real quick, Jesse, indulge me. What kind of record player did you get for the office?
That is a Project Carbon.
Ooh.
Which is kind of nice, but
they're not bad. Yeah, they're pretty solid for the money.
Yeah, it's a for the money purchase.
Yeah. Winner, what's your jam this week?
I got it on sale, Oliver.
From where?
Got it for cheap.
Yeah.
All right, this isn't Gearhead magazine, okay?
Okay.
What are you wearing? What kind of record player do you have?
This month
what
in
kind of
Gear-
artisanal whiskey
this
are you
month
drinking?
In Gearhead magazine. Turntables.
How's the wow
and
flutter?
Other fancy lad content.
Winner, what is your jam this week?
Can't Feel My Face by The Weeknd. Mm. And I was defending this in the Pop Rocket Facebook group because I love you guys on there too.
Winter does. She said that off microphone like an hour ago. I heard
I
her
do.
Say it. She does for real.
The song is totally different than his usual shit. His usual like really slow melody, like, you know, I'm seducing you, come to my bed, come to me, like that whole thing. And it's more like a summer like pep thing. And I was saying, you know, on our Summer Jam episode, I don't know what's going to be my summer jam. It might just be Uptown Funk for the next 5 years. I don't know.
Oh, please, no.
Please don't do that.
What, y'all? That
you can
trash.
Do one credited songwriter a
that
month.
That song
for the
is
next
all,
five years.
It's all false climaxes, so, one about, after another.
Coming back to The Weeknd, we're about to hear this, but real quick, yes. Is this a cocaine song?
No.
Okay.
He's
well,
talking
it's called
about,
Can't Feel My Face.
No,
so
I mean, it's drunk,
be.
Right?
Like, no, he's talking about I'm somebody's sitting on my face. I'm excited. He's talking about oral sex.
I think
Can't Feel My Face.
I think
it
could be
I can't feel my
ways.
Face with I'm with you.
So deeply engaged in cunnilingus.
Yes.
That his face has gone to sleep.
No.
Has that ever happened to you? I mean, seriously.
He can't feel his face because she's sitting on top
all right,
of him.
I think we got to hear this. She told me don't worry no more. We both know we can't go
without it. She told me you'll never be alone. She's never leaving because he's great at giving head. I can feel my face when I'm with you. But I
love it. But I love it. Oh. Maybe he's dating an oral surgeon. You know a lot
or,
about
a or a dentist.
There's a part where it like goes with like they do that like that harmonic thing. Like
can I ask you guys a serious question? Why do I not really like The Weeknd but love Frank Ocean so much?
Because The Weeknd looks like somebody you'd want to cross the street from if you saw him coming down the street. His hair looks unwashed. He probably drinks too much and probably does a lot of cocaine. I don't know. Allegedly. I don't know. But he's not as cute and as, you know, like friendly looking as Frank Ocean.
Because The Weeknd spells his name without the
Ian. That bothers me.
And that
me
just bugs the shit out of me.
That bothers me so much. What are you, a 2007 startup?
E Weeknd?
Like Twitter. Like how Twitter used to be when it left off the ER. Like
he should be called, called myweekend.com.
/
All right, Margaret, how about you? What is your jam for the week?
My favorite R&B singer is Fog Dog, by the way.
I'm a little sad that Guy's not here because I was going to come at him hard Uh-oh. With this jam to replace the madness that he spoke of on Twitter.
He's posting a lot on Facebook right now, just FYI. I've been scrolling it, so nice of you to be a part of the group.
Well, he was talking all this mess about how he's going to pick Ed Sheeran's Get Up and Dance.
Shut up and
like,
told
shut
him to hang
dance.
Up and call again.
I
and
did
I was
tell
like
him
standing
to
and clapping
exactly.
For you like
redial.
Orson Welles.
So, Guy, if you're out there listening, and you are, I want you to consider this jam from the Chemical Brothers with Q-Tip. And mm-hmm. part of the reason this is such a fucking great song is because it is a song that you can, like, wear a spacesuit to and feel really good about. Like, that is just the vibe of the song.
I would think just wearing the spacesuit would make you feel pretty good. You don't even need the song.
It's
the spacesuit itself sounds
yeah.
like a good thing.
It's a silent disco song for sure. This is a good one. Everybody got a target tonight. Everybody come along for the ride. All you studs and your duds and your ladies is fly. Grip the moment like you're gripping the earth. Feel the weight and you're feeling the girth. Now you get it, now you're feeling your worth. Fitness that you used to make when everything used to hurt. It goes,
very mid-80s. Like, I feel like the Art of Noise might have produced
Isn't
this.
He in Galvanized? He's on Galvanized.
He's in Galvanized, yeah.
I love when these two come together.
Yes, I agree.
Like an A-team.
Yes, it is
episode.
Total A-team time.
Like, plan, action.
Yeah.
It's powerful.
I don't know. It just gets me completely pumped. It's from the album that they're going to release this summer called...
Born in the Echoes.
That's right. And, I mean, this song, I love it so much that even though it was used in a Google Keynote address...
Shark Jump.
which would make me
dead on arrival. If that's
I know, dance the entire I know. Time. It makes me want to puke a little in my mouth, but I still really love it.
If you guys are wondering what kind of dance Winter's doing right now, it's one with a lot of pointing.
Yes.
That's what they did when he came out. Whoever at Google, he was like, I love this.
Sergey Brin was like,
cherry picking all
over there, over there, over there,
over there, over there, over there, over there.
I have to say, Q-Tip, because he has that beautiful voice, I think he'll be able to just do that until he's 70.
Yes,
I agree.
Which is
yes,
so unusual for a rapper from that era. I mean, like, Q-Tip isn't exactly super scientifical, you know what I mean? But he has that, but he has that beautiful voice, right. And he can just come out and rap a little bit gently and in a friendly type manner like that, and it'll sound like fun forever.
You know what I love about that song and his rap there is that he sounds like a little disturbed and rattled, and he usually doesn't sound like that. Mm-hmm. That's what I love about it, too, is that, you know, usually Q-Tip is like, he can almost be a little too cool, a little too reserved, too removed. But in that song, he's like kind of in it more and like getting messed around.
He sounds like the kind of person you're having like a really quick chat with and catching up, and then you're moving on. Like, that's the way he approaches everything.
Yeah, very conversational.
Thank God he's not singing. Remember when he sang? God, that stunk.
Vibrant thing.
No, I think you're talking about the Kamal,
Kamal the Abstract.
I got blacklisted by him over that album, but
really?
We don't have to get into that. All right, so my jam for the week, we are the resurrection of Janet Jackson. Who was she on the BET Awards? I didn't catch this, but
yeah, she was.
Was this the big? I think was did she
She's
have a
wearing
big
a
field performance?
Very lovely white pantsuit.
Beautiful.
Oh, okay,
Janet's a lovely.
Love will never do era look. Aesthetic.
I mean, let's be honest. It was wholly unfair that she got exiled because of the Super Bowl snafu when Justin Timberlake didn't have to pay the price on that shit at all.
Bullshit.
Yes.
So
bullshit.
Definitely some sexism, some racism perhaps involved there. She's been out of the mix. It's really nice to see her back into it. Her new song is produced by her classic collaborators, Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. It's called No Sleep. It is sexy. Come on. You've been
so classic.
And you could put Q-Tip on this too. I mean, obviously they've worked together before, but there needs to be a Q-Tip remix.
I feel like a remix is coming out soon on this one.
This is some face. I feel like this is some face sitting music right here.
Yeah, sure is.
Yeah.
Wow, guys.
You bet. I can't feel my face right now. Just thinking about Janet Jackson.
It's just so weird that there was so much fear of this black titty that took her out of commission for so long that she can't. She needs a comeback. She needs a comeback like no other.
Her face when that happened is still like burned in my mind.
The shock face.
Yeah, just like.
No, his face too.
Yeah.
Janet Jackson's cool. I just bought a copy of Control at the flea market this
week. Love it.
Bought one?
Yeah.
One of my childhood favorites.
Purchased?
We are all.
With money?
$2.
Why is this surprising to you?
Because I just, you know how I feel about my music. How I procure my music.
We're just not paying for it? Is that what you're saying?
I pay a monthly fee.
Okay.
Just like a storage unit, okay?
By the way, Oliver has so much physical music at his house, he literally has a storage unit full of music.
You have been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Oliver Wang, sitting in for our missing
hoarding.
Action, Guy Branum.
Classy hoarding. Oliver Wang, the classy hoarder.
All right, you guys are blowing my whole outro here. I gotta do this over.
Keep going.
You got it.
I'm Oliver Wang, the classy hoarder. You've been listening to Pop Rocket.
Okay. Anyways, I've been sitting in for Guy Branum. He will be back, I'm sure, with us next week. We've had Margaret Mitchell. I always wanted to put his name.
Was she
every time.
When was she?
We wrote Gone with the Wind together.
Her last name.
Did we write Out of Africa? I don't remember.
Come on, Winter Waffler actually sounds like a really good name,
Waffler.
Too. It's got the alliteration thing going.
With the news.
Winter Mitchell Affleck.
Winter Mitchell Affleck.
Yes, soon to be.
No hyphen.
Soon to be. So we've had Winter Mitchell with us, Margaret Waffler, special guest Jesse Thorne. We post show notes every week on the website, and we're going to do the round robin thank yous for the people who have given us 5-star reviews in iTunes. That includes YDNew9,
Farah Dork,
Dank Lord Gannon,
Adam Parnes,
Scott Ricketts,
Bunny Ventail,
Eliza Bird.
Love Eliza Bird.
Isn't it Eliza Bird, guys?
It's Eliza Bird.
I'm sorry. Okay. My bad. Eliza Bird.
And Jason in the O.C.
Way creative, Jason in the O.C.
I've been.
Let me guess. Your name, Jason. Do you live in the O.C.?
Do you wear cargo pants?
Do you wear cargo pants?
He gave us 5 stars. Do not mock our 5-star reviewers.
We love him. We love
that special
Winter
shout
would
out.
Prefer if his name was Dank Lord Jesse
in the O.C.
Dank Lord of the O.C. would be on
amazing.
Point.
Well, consider it.
If you haven't yet, give us a 5-star review. I mean, we'll mispronounce your name here on Pop Rocket. Get in touch with us on Twitter at Pop Rocket. Join our Facebook group. This week, tell us if you couldn't be the audiobook narrator to your own autobiography, who would you choose? And we are a production of listener-supported Maximum Fun, and our producer is the always lovely Colin Anderson.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.